We will start today with a public hearing. Actually, we have had each one of these bills up before, but we have amendments back, I think, as I understand, on all three of them. We'll go ahead and make it a public hearing, though, to begin with, starting with House Bill 2125. I will open that, and is the witness sheet on its way? Thank you. Okay. Invite Treasurer Randall Edwards to join us, and Ed, if you want to tell us a little bit about the amendments.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2125, as you will recall, is a it makes some administrative changes to the qualified state tuition program. The bill requires amount of non-qualified withdrawals to be added back into taxable income. There was a question last time whether the language of the bill did what the sponsors wanted it to do. So dash one amendments were drafted, which changed the mechanics of the add back if a non-qualified withdrawal is determined to have occurred. We also have dash two amendments, which were requested as a hedge, really, against any possible federal changes to the existing program, which might, for example, the there may be a subtraction or deduction allowed for federal tax purposes in the near future. If that happens, then the dash two amendments would disallow a double deduction, basically. So you get either the federal subtraction passed through to Oregon, or the Oregon deduction, but not both.
Okay. Mr. Treasurer, welcome back.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon, and thank you for letting us come back to talk to you a little bit about an amendment we have before you, which we believe now addresses the issue we were trying to in the original bill, and that is one of the setup is this. We sit in the bill that we passed in 1999. One of the features of this program is to allow each year joint filers or single filers the ability to deduct money off of their taxable income for monies going into this plan. For joint filers, it's $2,000. For single filers, it's $1,000. And as background, as you recall, this whole plan is designed to have Oregonians put money aside for educational purposes, and federal law binds us that that is how these monies will be used. So that's the whole public policy behind this, is for higher educational purposes. What we didn't want to create and what we were trying to achieve in the original bill and then what we've come to you with the dash one is to prohibit a situation where somebody would open an account in one day, be able to take in that tax year a deduction off their state taxable income. So they put in $2,000, open the account, be able to then go and close the account right shortly thereafter in a short time period and not use the money for educational purposes and get the tax deduction and then continue to do that. So what we've done is to try to close that loophole is to say for 1 year upon the time you open an account, if you close it, you cannot take the deduction, is that right? So that's how the bill was drafted. So for 1 year, you have a moratorium on doing that, basically trying to take advantage of the tax purpose. And again, we're trying to anticipate a potential problem. I'm not suggesting that this is going to happen, but at the end of the day, the whole policy behind this bill was to get individuals to save and to make sure this wasn't being used in a certain way for a tax loophole. It really, my guess is over time, if this were to happen, it would be very, very nominally used, if at all, and we're just trying to prevent any sort of opportunity for somebody to take advantage of what is a great public policy.
Okay. So you open the plan, you put your, pick a number, 2,000, into the plan.
–
what you're getting at is then somebody who takes advantage of the favorable treatment of that initial investment of the $2,000, then pulling that money out for a non-qualified expenditure.
Right. And Mr. Chair, the way the federal statute is written in the tax policy, if you use it for non-qualified purposes, there's a 10% penalty on the earnings in the account. So in essence, you know, there won't be a lot of there wouldn't be a lot of earnings over a year, but the point is you're trying to make sure that because we have this additional feature of $2,000 on your state income tax, that might be an incentive enough to open and close and get that tax benefit. So the penalty that's out there long term, if you hold the money and you end up buying a car with this, you will be assessed a penalty, which could be very meaningful on the earnings over 10 years, let's say. But in a short period of time, we were trying to close this door that a potential would be somebody might look at it and take an advantage of the state tax deduction, the $2,000 per year for joint filers.
So the concern being that even with the 10% federal penalty, you could come out ahead if you move quickly
right.
On your state tax.
Right. Exactly.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beck.
Does the you have to have a child identified? I think I asked maybe for the last hearing. Do you have to have a child born to contribute, right?
I assume. There has to be an entity, yes.
So let's say you put money into the account for your child, and 3 years later your child has dies.
You're real down, aren't you?
Eeyore. And you got this money sitting here. You don't have any other children. And you don't plan to use it. Then maybe there are provisions in the law already for something like that.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Michael Parker, the executive director of the plan. Representative Beck, if the child dies or receives a scholarship, you can take the money out without penalty. In the case of death, disability, or scholarship, the 10% penalty is not assessed.
Right.
I think a question came up before the hearing, and I want to get on the record. We're talking about the 10% federal penalty. Is there a penalty at a state level, too, for early withdrawal?
To clarify how the penalty works, if you take the money, if you're contributing and decide that you want to use it for non-educational purposes, you take a non-qualified withdrawal. That means you pay state taxes at your level instead of the student's level, federal taxes at your level instead of the student's level, and an additional 10% penalty is assessed on the earnings portion, which comes back to the plan. So both state and federal taxes are paid at your level, the higher level, and an additional 10% penalty on earnings is assessed. And that doesn't go to the federal government. It comes back to the plan.
Questions?
I have a broader question about the plan. If while you're here, Randall, your letter states that 1,200 people and $3 million. Are you guys going to? I know we saw some of your marketing information, and you intend to reach out. One concern that one might have about this plan is it's going to tend to attract educated families, people who are just informed about what's going on in the world and thinking long-term. And I'm sure you're going to try to get this into the hands of other, not the usual suspects. I'm wondering if you're going to keep, can you keep record of income levels of people who have contributed to the plan and also geographical distribution? Is that public information? Did you ask that when they contribute? And if not, could we do that? Just so, say 5 years from now, we'll know what types of people are contributing, and if it turns out we're not getting lower middle income people or whatever, or certain demographics, that maybe we need to market it differently or more.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, the challenge you're posing there is one that I personally take very seriously about how we make sure this is accessible to as many Oregonians as possible. I mean, a couple of things. One, the plan itself, you can open up an account with as little as $25 a month deposit, direct deposit. So that helps, I think, some barriers. Obviously, at the end of the day, you got to get people to put the money in.
Right.
So direct deposit generally works pretty well, and that's a pretty low threshold. The other is, this is a statewide program, like you're saying, and my commitment is to take this out as we market it not only in the paid media, but in the free media to go around the state and tell people what this opportunity is. This will outlive my treasury. It will be the hallmark of this office for perpetuity and for the state that we have this tool. So we're in the process right now of putting together our marketing plan, and we'll make sure that we look at those demographics and social economic issues out there and distribution around the state. My goal is to try to spread this out and get as many people and use as many different channels of distribution as possible, working with employers to have them set it up in their companies, to have so that their employees can make a direct deposit and perhaps the company themselves might deposit into it. Those are the ways you can start reaching out to many people around the state.
Mr. Chair.
Sure.
So do you have, if we were to say, who are, not by name, but who are these 1,200 people, do we have a way of breaking that down, or is there confidential information that isn't available?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, we do actually on the application form track age of the beneficiary, income level of the participants, and geographic distribution. So that is on the enrollment form that is required to participate in the plan. So that is tracked, and that information can be provided to the legislature.
Great.
Representative Hess.
Back to the bill, just to make sure I'm clear. What you're trying to protect there against is someone who puts $2,000 in, takes a tax break, takes $2,000 out, the next year puts $2,000 in, and just keeps doing that.
Right.
And even if they did that, even with the penalties, they could still come out ahead in some circumstances.
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, the way the bill, current law works in the penalties assessed on the earnings, the 10%, and if it was a very short time period, there'd be no earnings, quite frankly, and so therefore the tax benefit to you, depending on your tax bracket, would probably outstrip. I mean, you would still get a break, and then that's what we're trying to stop. It's like anything; you could always try to anticipate somebody else doing something, but it seemed glaring enough that we should try to stop it. And I think by just having this there, there's a statement that you're making in law that we don't want that to happen. Again, the policy here is to try to encourage people to save and save for higher educational needs.
That's great. A tax
shelter. Exactly.
Ed, if you could, or any other questions, any members? Ed, if you could help me out, beginning with the comma on line 4 of the dash 1, I always have trouble with, and it seems to be a typical of the tax code, but when you have language that says, to the extent the amount added to federal taxable income under this paragraph does not exceed the lesser of, and then we have those two, the total amount or $2,000. Can you create a couple of hypotheticals that show how that works? So you can, or feel free to jump in on that side. But what is this business of the total amount contributed within 12 months or $2,000, and it would be the lesser of those two amounts?
Craig, Mr. Chair, currently the subtraction is available for annual contributions up to $2,000.
Right.
So that would be the amount that potentially has been subtracted from taxable income.
Okay, so the most they would have gotten a break on is the $2,000. So they could have contributed $5,000.
Right.
We're not going to penalize them for the excess $3,000 because they didn't get any tax break for the excess $3,000.
Exactly.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay.
There you go.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Notice that it does specify only that the amounts contributed within the last 12 months need to be added back in the case of a non-qualified withdrawal. The original bill included language adding back everything contributed from time zero up to the non-qualified withdrawal was made.
And the reason for the shortening of that time period again?
Yeah, the reason for the shortening of the time period is because there is that 10% penalty that we are assessing. So someone may have had good intentions of using the money for college and then for circumstances beyond their control couldn't use it. I guess we'd hate to penalize them on that, but they are getting penalized on the 10% on the earnings. So there is a penalty attached, which could be substantial if you had substantial earnings in the plan.
Okay. And figuring that the 1 year is, that's your tax dodge time period. If someone's in longer than that, there's probably other.
Correct.
I mean, if we see this as a problem, Mr. Chair, over time, we'll come back and make a change.
Okay.
Or ask for a change.
We hope that somebody will,
you will make
remember what this plan is when you try to term limited environment. Representative Bate.
Well, your question generated another one for me, Mr. Chair. If someone puts in $20,000, I mean, for a 16-year-old, say, they want to build it up, is all the earnings tax-free, federal and state, then, on that amount of money? You don't get the deduction only for the $2,000, but if someone puts a big chunk in, it would have a lot more earnings, obviously, over a shorter period of time. Is that money then, the earnings, then, tax-free, federal, state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, the plan, it's a deferral on the growth on that $20,000. There's two tax components. The first $2,000 on your state taxable income, you can deduct on against your state
tax. Okay.
But the $20,000, total $20,000 as it's growing, there's a deferral on the tax of state and federal. And then it's taxed at the beneficiary's rate.
Yeah, at the student's rate.
The student's rate.
I misspoke. I actually knew that. I misspoke.
Okay.
But during the time of its growth, it's not taxed.
Correct.
It's not taxed. It's brought out, and it's brought out at the student's level.
Correct.
Okay. And do the Dash 2 need any further introduction than you gave them?
You get the first 2,000.
Anticipate changes in the federal law?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. They'll have Dash 2s. Will have no effect if the feds don't make a change, but if they happen to make contributions to these accounts, at least somewhat deductible or subtractable, this will act as a hedge in that case.
Okay.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for these? Anybody else wish to make any comments on House Bill 2125 and the amendments that are in front of us? If not, I will close the public hearing and open the work session on House Bill 2125.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kapoori.
Can I start with the two?
Either one.
I move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2125.
Representative Kapoori moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2125. Is there any discussion, any objection to the Dash 2 amendments? All right. Representative Kapoori.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2125.
Representative Kapoori moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2125. Any discussion? Objection? Therein too.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kapoori.
I move House Bill 2125 as amended to the floor with a due cap recommendation.
Representative Kapoori moves House Bill 2125 to the floor as amended by the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on the bill as amended? Please call the roll.
Yes.
Jeff.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Powell.
Aye.
William.
Aye.
Lea.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Carlson. Aye.
Safari.
Aye.
Votes aye. House Bill 2125 as amended goes to the floor. Chair will carry this one. Next we'll go to House Bill 2029. Who do we need up here for that? Open a public hearing on that.
I gotta sign my son up for it. That's on the floor of my bedroom.
Diane Belt, welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's see. Elizabeth, do you want to catch us up to speed on this?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, what you have with House Bill 2029 is a Dash 1 amendment. And I've also given you, it's basically Dash 1 is specifying what real machinery and equipment is actually going to be affected by this bill. And it refers to 308.115 and it's subsection 3. So that's copied for you, just for your own reference. But basically, this is going to be the real machinery and equipment that applies just to that which is owned separately from the land and the building. So that's all this amendment is doing. It will not change anything with the revenue impact.
Okay. Diane, these are your A1 or 1A accounts. Is that what you're talking about?
Mr. Chair, yeah, that is correct. For the record, my name is Diane Belt with Washington County Tax Department, and I'm also representing the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors. Yes, what this does is this is the definition by statute of an A1 account, which basically states sub 3 that whenever any building, structure, improvement, machinery, equipment, or fixture is owned separately and apart from the land or real property whereon it stands or to which it is affixed, such building, structure, improvement, machinery, equipment, or fixture shall be assessed and taxed in the name of the owner thereof. And speaking with AOI, and Mr. Tappanen was fine with this.
All right, I think that's what we wanted done with this. Gary, a nod of the head. All right, I heard that. Any questions for Diane? Thank you. I'll close the public hearing. Anybody else wish to testify on 2029? If not, I'll close the public hearing on that then and go right to work session. We're in work session on House Bill 2029. Representative Beck.
Mr. Chairman, are we adopting amendments?
I think we are.
I would move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2029.
Representative Beck moves the dash one amendment to House Bill 2029. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? Okay, that's carried.
Mr. Chairman, I would move House Bill 2029 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Representative Beck moves House Bill 2029 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, please call the roll.
Representative
Kay. Aye.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Half.
Aye.
William.
Excused.
Webb.
Excused.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Excused.
McCoy.
Aye.
Chair Shatterman.
Aye. House Bill 2029 passes. Before the due pass recommendation, we need a carrier.
I will take that on.
Back. Okay. I'll make sure we're being fair to everybody here. That means you can't dodge either. Okay.
Does it mean, Mr. Chairman, if we accept a high number of carrier bills earlier on in the session, that we can pass them out heavily to other people?
Well, I'll have to keep track where the easy ones are coming out
first.
Representative Beck, I hear you loud and clear. I'll take the next one.
Okay, let's deal with this when the people aren't listening. Okay. Issues of committee discipline.
Sorry.
House Bill 2031 is up next. We have amendments on that. I'll open a public hearing and welcome back Diane. And Elizabeth, if you want to bring us up to date on that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, with House Bill 2031, we basically have a dash one amendment, which is raising the value of the manufactured dwelling from $3,500 to $8,000 or less if there is no buyer at a sale of a manufactured structure. And it's clearly specifying now the four distinct conditions when the county tax collector will cancel all unpaid property taxes on the abandoned manufactured structure. So first condition is when the landlord disposes of a manufactured dwelling which is valued less than $8,000. If there is no buyer at the sale of an abandoned manufactured dwelling, then the current value is set at $8,000 or less and the landlord destroys the property. The third condition is there is a buyer at a sale of a manufactured dwelling and the current market value of the structure is $8,000 or less, and the proceeds of the sale are insufficient to satisfy the unpaid property taxes. And finally, the fourth condition is if the landlord buys a structure, the manufactured structure, and it has a current market value of more than $8,000, but the proceeds of the sale are insufficient to pay the back taxes, and the landlord disposes of the structure. So this is changing two different statutes in the same manner with these same changes. It's 90.425 and 90.675. The revenue impact is indeterminate, but it should have only a minimal tax impact statewide. This is going to allow counties now to collect unpaid property taxes from landlords of manufactured home parks who are choosing to buy in an abandoned manufactured structure and not destroy it. So this is a very, rare case each year, but there will be a few cases now where landlords may choose to buy these manufactured homes that have been abandoned and not destroy them and pay, then they would be paying the property taxes. Under current law, they would not be paying those property taxes.
Okay. Diane.
Okay, Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Diane Belt, and I represent the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors. I'm also the personal property tax collector for Washington County. House Bill 2031 and the amendments, and If you have questions about the amendments, John Van Landingham, who is the scribe, is here, and I will defer to him because it gets a little technical. But to try to make it easier to understand, I did two flow charts for you. One that is...
We're getting your... Is this your testimony that you brought in today?
Yes.
Okay, we're just...
Oh, and here you go.
Now. Thank you.
Oh, good. There are two flow charts. One shows the current process under the 1999 abandonment process, and the other flow chart shows the proposed amendments. And basically, the manufactured home abandonment process began with the 1997 session, and I think we talked a little bit about this last week. And at that time, there were a lot of manufactured homeowners with homes that were difficult to sell, either because of their condition, there was no place to move them, and unfortunately a lot of folks just basically walked from those homes. And the park was left with the responsibility to try to deal with disposing of that home. They came to us at that time and said, well, we'd like to work out an abandonment process in order for us to dispose or get rid of these homes. Would you be willing to waive the tax? Well, looking at it, you know, like a business, it was more cost effective for us to walk away and let the park dispose of the home. And that's what happened. Unfortunately, in the last several years, what's happened is what used to be old, dilapidated, we call them junky homes, have now turned into nicer homes because of the condition in the market right now. And the intent of the abandonment process was to be able to assist the landlord in getting rid of these homes. And in some cases, and some landlords were using the process to retain the home. And that was not the intent. So the coalition has been working with this issue, and this is what we came up with, which I think works for everybody. So what we're doing is we are increasing the throwaway value, if you want to call it that, from $3,500 to $8,000. And we're allowing, like Elizabeth said, for cancellation in only four circumstances. One is if the current market value of the home is $8,000 or less, the home may be destroyed or disposed of. If there is no purchaser at the sale, then the home is deemed to be worth $8,000, and then the park owner can dispose or destroy the home. If there are insufficient funds from the sale to pay the property taxes, which typically attorney fees come first, then unpaid rents, and then taxes, and I think I have had none that we've gotten down to the tax. Tax will be canceled. If there's insufficient funds from the sale to pay the property taxes and the landlord is the purchaser of the home, because a lot of times the landlord will bid in their expense to get the home, if they then destroy or dispose of the home, the taxes will be canceled. If they choose to keep the home, then the taxes will be due and payable. I think this is a good process. It addressed all of our issues. I think the gang is all here. The coalition is pretty much here. And we've worked really hard on this, and I believe we came to a very good agreement where everybody gave a little bit, but I think it will work very well for everybody.
Questions for Diane? One thing, I guess, that we're also deleting the language on page 5 of the bill regarding the purchase of the mobile home by a relative.
Yes. That in Mr. Chair, in
get some testimony about that.
Well, in the statute,
oh, I want to raise a problem.
I know.
Okay.
No, actually, in the statute, when you if you read through it, it's a long statute, and when you read through it, it actually when it defines dispose or destroy of at an $8,000 level right off the get go, it is already described in there that. Relative or an owner of the park cannot benefit from the sale. That's if right off the bat it's $8,000 and they dispose or destroy of it. So that's probably already been covered.
Okay. Representative Bates.
I may be carrying this bill from my previous.
I was going to say you shouldn't
and,
speak to.
And Kathy Lowell will fry me on this if I'm not careful. Disposes, you may have answered the question already, disposes in this in context means destroy, I assume, or move to a place where it can be destroyed. It doesn't mean resell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, dispose means that it needs to be given away without consideration.
That's supposed to make
and
it
here, not quite. Here comes the scribe.
Dispose is defined on, it's in the current law, defined on page 1, lines 12 through 15. throw away, give it without consideration to a nonprofit or a person unrelated to the landlord.
And follow-up question?
Sure.
Chair? And you said some of the statute also says that disposition cannot result in a gain for a relative or an owner of the park, I assume. So we don't want to be in a situation where under D here, somebody can buy a manufactured structure that's worth $20,000 because nobody showed up for the sale, buys it for a couple thousand, pays the back taxes, and makes a profit. That's not the goal. The goal is to get rid of abandoned buildings, abandoned manufactured homes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, my name is John Van Landingham. I'm a lawyer with Lane County Law and Advocacy in Lane County, basically a legal services lawyer. I've been the principal drafter of amendments to the Landlord-Tenant Act since 1991. That's not correct. A landlord can profit as long as the landlord pays the back taxes. I can say more if you want, but if a landlord's willing to pay the back taxes, has bought the home at the sale, wants to keep it in the park and offer it as affordable housing or low-cost housing, that's allowed.
Mr. Chair, I understand that. What I'm trying to get to is I don't want to be in a position that a landlord or a relative can buy a structure, not pay the back taxes, and profit from it. And I clearly understand that's not possible under this.
Correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to add, too, that there were some drafting errors, basically in verbiage, I believe, words, that we will address on the Senate side.
Okay. You're happy enough with it as it is?
Yes.
I have to admit that I missed part of the hearing last week, so maybe you talked about it then, but what was the rationale for moving the cost of the dwelling from $3,500 to $8,000?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kafoury, $3,500 was a figure that was arrived at several years ago in 1997, and at that point in time it was basically an amount that the lenders would be willing to walk away from. That amount has increased over the last several years. A lot of it maybe the condition of the home, the amount of storage fees that may be incurred, and there actually are homes of maybe more value than that some of the lenders are choosing to walk away from. And also we kind of looked at the values that are on the county rolls. And unfortunately, a lot of those values are probably don't reflect the current market, because the market in the last 18 months has drastically changed. And so we talked about it and decided to raise that to $8,000. And the lenders had no problem with it. The Tenants Association, we're going to start there.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. There's nobody else signed up here, but I do want to recognize that we have, as Diane said, other members of the coalition here. And if anybody wants to be heard on this, I welcome anybody to come forward.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. I'm Chuck Carpenter, Executive Director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. And we spent a considerable amount of time with Diane and in the coalition working on this, and we have no problem with it.
Perfect. Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Sally Harrington. I'm Vice President of Commonwealth Real Estate Services, and we manage over 70 mobile home communities in the state of Oregon. And I have actively participated in the coalition from the beginning of this bill, and we support this bill.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Anybody else? And we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2031 and open a work session on that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beck, was it?
Yep. Moves the adoption of the -1 amendments to House Bill 2031.
Thank you. Representative Beck moves the -1 amendments into House Bill 2031. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2031 as amended to the floor. Due pass.
Representative Beck moves House Bill 2031 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? If not, then please call the roll.
Representative Bates.
Aye.
Bass.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Cass.
Aye.
Williams.
Used.
Whip.
Used.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Kafoury.
Aye.
Chair Shadowley.
Aye. House Bill 2031 as amended passes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We need a carrier on that now, Representative Bates. All right, Representative Brown, you're next.
I would also recommend, Mr. Chair, that in the future when we need carriers, that this should be the people who have been excused.
Speaking of which, Representative Kafoury, would you please request unanimous consent to return to work session on House Bill 2029 to allow Representative Carlson to cast a vote?
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I request unanimous consent to return to House Bill 2029 so that Representative Carlson be allowed to cast her vote.
Representative Kafoury requests unanimous consent that we return to the work session on House Bill 2029 to allow Representative Carlson to cast a vote on the bill. Is there any objection? Hearing none, Representative Carlson, how do you vote on House Bill 2029 as amended? Thank you. Votes aye.
Thank you very much.
That work session and... without further business, adjourned.
Adjourned.
Oh, we do.
That's
working.
That is landlord because of our privilege.
Oh, yours.
Oh, and our superlative witnesses that come up.
Yes, we're happy. We worked on it. We like it. We have no objection.
We're upstairs.
We do have to get it. We won't tell you about it.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
we say don't tell you about it.
Well,
they just want it rented out.
Right.
More than 8,000.
You haven't been?
Yeah. Well, more than 8,000.